Kamenetsky Brothers Podcast, Brian Kamenetsky, Andy Kamenetsky coming to you Friday afternoon, about a little more than a week after Mike D'Antoni resigned. They kind of snuck that resignation in there in between the Donald Sterling ban and the Kings and modern family. I don't know.
Well, they actually, I mean, you didn't necessarily want to sneak in the resignation because that's what fans wanted.
Right, that's good news.
But what I tweeted out is if they plan to keep D'Antoni, they needed to put that press release right in at the time of the Sterling ban because nobody was paying attention. The best way to handle it would have been actually to release the press release during Adam Silver's press conference.
Yeah, what they should have done is, like, because they released a statement from Jeannie Buss, if they were going to do it that way, like, and in parentheses, after the strong condemnation of Donald Sterling, just in a little parenthetical, oh, by the way, D'Antoni's coming back. Like, that's it.
And the beauty of that, again, this didn't end
didn't
up
happen.
But the beauty of that would have been that if you were asked about that immediately, you just play the, you know, now is not the time to talk about this. We're dealing with much larger issues
right in
the NBA. These are larger causes than anything involving our coach. And you play that card for about 6 or 7 months. and then by the time it's over, D'Antoni's basically done with his final year of his contract.
You can even get really indignant about it. How dare you? How dare you ask me about that right now while we are dealing with such important social issues? How dare you, sir?
Who the hell do you think you are, Ding?
Yeah. Brez. Dave McMenamin.
Not us, because nobody expects us to actually bother to see comment.
The Kamenetskys just
like,
wrote.
They kept him, whatever.
They just wrote something that they assumed somebody would have said.
They leached onto everybody else's work.
The Kamenetskys sought comment from each other. but, you know, Mike D'Antoni's gone, Andy. And since then, basically, everyone who has ever coached anything or played the game of basketball anywhere has been put on the list of people who might be the next coach of the Lakers.
It is a long and seemingly increasing list by the day.
And kind of incongruent, and that's all stuff that we're going to get into. I think some very interesting stuff that came out of the Kevin Durant, now famous, forever famous, Kevin Durant Mother's Day press conference.
That's a hell of a speech.
Oh my God, it was good. And so we'll talk a little bit about that, not just about how good a speech it was, but some of the things that kind of reflect on L.A. and the modern basketball player and all that kind of stuff. We'll get to that.
I misheard you. Did you call it the MVP speech or his Mother's Day speech?
He called it his Mother's Day speech. Because it has forever ruined Mother's Day for anyone who's ever going to give anything to their mother.
Yeah, ironically, Durant's speech brought a lot of, you know, spotlight even more on himself and on this series going on between him and the Clippers. And game four is on Sunday. And because of that heartfelt speech to his mother, anybody with a mother or a wife who happens to also be a mother has absolutely no prayer watching a game now.
Yep. Can't do it. All right. So we'll get all of that. We got a good ACK question coming later in the show. And I'm sure we'll talk about something else. But in the meantime, before we get to that, we cannot do those things, Andy, without getting to today's big headlines. We're going to start with Donald Sterling and Shelley Sterling keeping the strange and estranged since, what, like 2012 or so? A weird couple, I think, to say the least. Donald Sterling on a new recording, or a couple new recordings, really, appearing at radaronline.com. He says a lot of things, many of which are very creepy, almost all of which are kind of sad and pathetic. But for the purposes of holding on to the Clippers, here's the important thing, Andy. He's not a racist.
No, he claims he is not a racist. He's on the phone presumably with a black friend of his, unidentifying, maybe now
ex-friend. Why are all of Donald Sterling's friends and acquaintances recording him and releasing these recordings to the public?
Well, there's a part of me also wondering if Sterling was the one that actually recorded this one to make sure that it got out, because it's a pretty amazing coincidence that a recording where he makes his case as a non-racist just happens to get out
on the
heels of this scandal.
Because he also, though, while he may be making his case as a non-racist, Andy, he's also making his case as a very, very dirty old man.
Well, you know,
very dirty man. I've never been a guy who really likes the expression play when used in terms of sex. I've never liked that. I think it's weird and creepy. I'm like, oh, let's play. No, let's not. Let's have sex or whatever it is we're going to do. But hearing him talk about he just wanted to play with V. Stiviano, and what if Magic Johnson had a girl that he wanted to play with, and how he wants to, when he wants to have sex with a girl, when he wants to play. It was the most creepy, off-putting thing. Donald Sterling is a horn dog, and that makes this whole thing that much worse. He says he was jealous. He says all kinds of things. But the thing that I found was amazing was apparently what that was when he was talking about V. Stiviano in that initial recording and talking about how he didn't want her to around black people and all these. That was apparently, if you believe Donald on the new recordings, that was flirting.
Yeah.
He was flirting.
That was game. That was game on Donald's part. He was sweet-talking her.
That used to work in the bars in 1968 or whatever. Anyway, so yeah, that's what was going on. We can only wait for the next Donald Sterling secret recording to find out more.
Again,
about this
I don't think this one is actually a secret. I really believe that Donald was behind this one, because there's one point at the end of the latest installment where he says, he's talking about, you know, how his privacy got invaded. And then he ends up saying, but, you know, this is just between us. You know, this isn't being recorded. I think he played the card a little too hard in this point. Like,
I mean, it's not like anyone's listening.
Hey, did you press record? I mean, that's what it felt like.
Yeah. All right. But it's not the only part of the Donald Sterling news this week, Andy, or Sterling news, I should say.
Yes. Rochelle Shelley Sterling, the estranged or loving wife of Donald, depending on the day that you ask, is also not going quietly into the night. She believes that she deserves part of the team and that she hasn't done anything wrong, and there's no reason that she should be removed from this equation. According to quotes from the Los Angeles Times, she believes that the ban and the fine does not, quote, apply to me or my family. I have been co-owner since 1981. During these 33 years, I've been a diehard fan even when the team was in the basement of the league.
So that's most of it.
Yeah.
Most of that.
Now that our hard work is paying off, I want to celebrate the success that we are finally achieving.
Yeah.
She also condemned, she said, her husband's racist comments, and in much stronger language than she used at the time when she was posing as a housing inspector to spy on the tenants in their building. It's a real change of tone on Rochelle's part.
Well, good for her. Good for Shelley. I will say this. I am pleased to be correct. From the beginning, I have thought that Shelley Sterling would be a bigger problem than Donald Sterling when it comes to solving this problem, and I appear to be correct about that. It is a complicated situation. I do wonder how they're going to figure out how to get rid of her, because I will say this. I'm not a lawyer. I don't know exactly how it's going to work, but there's no way in hell the league is going to let her hold on to this if they have any say in it whatsoever. Because like you alluded to, when you go back through all these depositions for the housing discrimination cases and all this other stuff, Rochelle Shelley Sterling is no innocent in this. She is a slum lordess to go along with his slum lording.
It's pretty telling, too. You know, Ralph Lawler, the longtime play-by-play man for the Clippers.
Bingo!
Bingo! Who really has not said anything, to the best of my knowledge, publicly commenting on this mess, was quoted as saying, "I think in the eyes of the players and the coaching staff and the basketball staff, the page has been turned, and it would be very difficult to turn it back." What I do think is interesting, though, in terms of her involvement, is there's some theory that this is actually just about saving Donald Sterling and, by extension, her extended family hundreds of millions in a capital gains tax. If the team basically stays in the Sterling name, whether Donald's, right, I guess, hers. By the time he dies, it's a much different tax implication than if he sells it while living. Right, so, I mean,
it's an estate tax thing versus a capital gains. Because remember, he bought the team for $15 million.
Right.
He'll sell it for $1.5 billion.
Right.
Or $15 million to $100.5 billion, or whatever.
This may have nothing to do with her actually wanting to stay involved with the team. It may just be a stall tactic.
Yeah, and in the end, I do think what until he dies, that's creepy. In the end, you know, it also
he's got
just
to keep him young.
It could be another way to just, you know, try to squeeze another couple hundred million out of the NBA.
Maybe to help pay for that capital gains tax. You never know.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, you know, here's the thing, though, Andy, when your investment goes from $15 million to $1.5 billion, it's not unfair to expect you to pay a little bit of tax on that.
Well, you know what? It would be unfair for most people, but I think Donald and Shelley have been through enough at
That's
this.
Fair point.
Finally, Andrew Bynum's season with the Pacers, Brian, has ended before it really even got started. Only played 2 games during the regular season, hasn't suited up during the playoffs, and is now officially no longer with the team. It has been announced that knee issues will prevent him from taking the court through the entirety of the playoffs, however long Indiana stays in. He is no longer traveling with the team. Frank Vogel, by the way, made it very clear this was not a disciplinary issue. Bynum got along with everyone fine. I don't even think he was around enough to even cause chemistry issues, and obviously people are taking a look at that with the Pacers now since they've been unraveling since
that wasn't Drew's fault. I mean,
I don't think
you can blame Drew for a lot of stuff, not for that.
Look, let's make it clear, he's capable of doing it.
Had he been there long enough, I'm sure he would have caused chemistry problems.
Let's not sell the guy short. Right. He could have ripped that team in half. He just didn't.
That's the one thing he can still do on an NBA team.
Which leads to my question, Brian. At this point, we've seen Bynum play about maybe 10 games over the last 2 years, something like that, 15 games, missed the entirety of last season with Philadelphia. Is this over for Andrew Bynum? Are we ever going to see him on an NBA team again?
I think it just depends on how much he wants to play on like a veteran's minimum contract. Like, because here's what it gets to. Like, we've spent so much time trying to analyze whether or not Andrew Bynum loves basketball or not. Does he really enjoy playing? Does he really enjoy the process of doing it? And I think what we're going to find out is probably not enough to go through. And I don't even begrudge him this, because at some point the writing is just on the wall. But, you know, I just don't think he's going to want to go through all of this, all of the rehab, all of the whatever, just so he can sign another minimum contract with another team and not play eventually. I mean, it's just not going to go well for him. He's made plenty of money. Like you say, he's played 26 games. I just looked up 26 games in like the last 3 years. It's just not going to work anymore. It's a shame. But, you know, I think at this point, maybe he tries one more time, and then that's it. I think we're basically done with sort of the Andrew Bynum era.
Yeah, he's a guy that is extremely smart and has a lot of outside interests and has the ability now to fund whatever route that he wants to go on. I mean, I don't think he's ever been truly passionate, you know, living, breathing, sleeping the game the way some of, you know, the guys like Kobe or whoever that he's played with are. You know, there was a period where Bynum actually did work his ass off. I mean, he went through one leg. I mean, went through the entire 2010 playoffs on one leg because he really wanted to be a part of that.
And he's done the rehab and he's tried.
Right. But he's broke. There is a point where there's no enjoyment left. And this isn't really worth it when you've already accomplished a certain amount of things. I can understand why Greg Oden might put himself through this, because he's never really experienced the NBA and he's never really experienced what he was supposed to. Bynum's actually experienced a lot in a short period of time.
I agree. So, disappointing news for Bynum. I don't think we'll see him really try again, though. Certainly nobody's going to give him the kind of money or the kind of contract that even Cleveland did a couple years back. So that's the end of that, probably. And that, Andy, is also the end of the headlines. See what I did there?
Yeah.
That was good.
That was excellent.
Let's get to the big news with the Lakers. They need a new coach.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Breaking news.
Yes, this happened between our podcasts, and people were like, when are you guys going to record? And, you know, well, now is the answer to that question.
We've been busy.
We've got stuff to do. And so what I think is the part, you know, obviously the focus is on who should they bring in? Is this guy a good fit? Is that guy a good fit? And that's the question that we get all the time. You know, people, you know, George Carlin's up on the list, or Roy Williams on the list. Mark Jackson gets fired. Is he the best fit for the Lakers? And so on and so on and so on. And the list is massive for the people they might hire. And my response to the question, whenever it is asked, is always, you know, I like Stan Van Gundy as a coach more than I like Byron Scott as a coach. But my answer is still always, who's on the team? Because I think it's really difficult. And this is the position the Lakers are in. And one of the reasons where I at least pointed out the upside to having D'Antoni come back for next year is it's very difficult to pick the coach when you have no idea who the personnel are going to be, not just next year, but who the next star is going to be and who the next star with the star is going to be after Kobe's gone. I don't have a great answer for who the next coach is. I can pick the guys who I think are good coaches versus more like candidates. But in terms of the best fit, I honestly have no idea. And I don't think they can really know either.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. I mean, trying to peg the best fit is absurd because the roster next year is going to be probably completely different than the one in 2016. And then it's going to change over again once Kobe retires. So,
By the way, I hope it is, because next year's roster is going to blow. I'd like it to get better with time.
It very well may. So, I mean, you're talking about, you know, maybe three very different incarnations for this coach, assuming he does last 3 years. We haven't had much luck with that lately. But and to me,
and by the way, if they hire Mike Brown again, you know that's just a placeholder thing.
I mean,
at this point, they just want to squeeze a year out of that, and then they can go on.
To me, ultimately, you're not really going to know if whoever they hire is the right guy or not for a few years, because I think it's really going to be impossible to judge him. So I think ultimately what the Lakers need to do, because I don't have a preferred candidate right now, Brian, honestly, I really don't. I mean, and to some degree, I don't even know how much it actually matters in tangible terms who they hire, because like I said, you're really not going to be able to figure out how good a coach this guy is for a few years anyway. I mean, it matters.
Or how good a fit, really. I mean,
right. Yeah. It matters in the sense that, you know, the fans, you could either placate them or piss them off even more. It matters in the sense that the Lakers need to create some stability because they become a revolving door.
Right.
With
you
coaches.
Don't want to, they don't want to, if whoever they hire, you don't want that person to have to be fired in 2 years.
Right. But that's actually what I'm getting to. Ultimately, what they need to do is find somebody that they believe in, and then you give him the space to operate, and you support him, and you make sure that there is going to be no interference run to him, whether from fans or media or players internally, whatever. You make sure that it's clear this is your guy and he's going to have room to grow. I think very similar to what Pat Riley did when Eric Spoelstra, everybody was calling for his head. Riley made it very clear, this is my guy. I'm not coming down. And whether that's because he truly believed in Spoelstra, because he didn't maybe think at the time this team was ready to win a title, so I don't know if I should come down, or if he was just worried about creating a culture where it looked like the president was going to cut off the coach's head whenever anything went wrong, Riley backed Spoelstra 100%. There was no ambiguity how he felt. And the Lakers need to make sure they do this with the next guy they hire, no matter who it is, and no matter who doesn't like him.
Yeah, Kobe?
For example.
No matter who doesn't like him only means Kobe.
Well, I don't know. I mean, let's be honest.
You're talking about Kobe.
No. Well, look, this doesn't get talked about a whole lot, Brian, but Robert Sacre has been on this team 2 years. Two coaches, kind of a coach killer.
Touche. I wrote about this before, where I feel like the most important attribute that the next Lakers coach is going to need to have is flexibility. I mean, like you say, the roster is going to be so different from year to year to year. You're not going to be able to anticipate. The NBA doesn't work where you can say, let's go get the power forward or the two guard or whatever that matches perfectly our guy. Sometimes it works. Pau Gasol was a perfect match for the triangle and Phil Jackson, but it doesn't always work that way. A lot of time it's who's available and who can we go get, and do we have the stuff to get him, whether it's money or trade pieces or whatever. So this coach, if he likes a stretch four, he might have a great one 1 year and a not so great one the next year. How's he going to turn his offense around? How's he going to make that work? You know, Kobe is a slow down post guy now. You know, is he going to be able to go from that style to maybe a more up-tempo thing if the guys they have after that are a better match? Defensively, changing rosters, can he come up with different schemes that don't rely on, you know, a Kevin Garnett or a Joakim Noah in the middle like, you know, Thibodeau had in Boston or in Chicago, and will continue to have in Chicago, by the way, because he's not coming here. But anyway, that's kind of why I, you know, my favorite guy on the list is Steve Kerr, who is reportedly choosing, you know, relatively quickly between the Knicks and the Warriors and isn't coming here. But it's basically the same phenomenon as what we talk about with guys like Dante Exum. I think we've talked about this, where it's, you know, the international guy, you can always just pin your hopes and dreams and aspirations. You can ascribe them qualities that they may or may not have because you haven't seen them. And so I can just assume that Steve Kerr, because he's been under Pop and D'Antoni and Phil, and he's seen a lot of different stuff, will be flexible and able to incorporate all these other things. I have no idea.
Yeah.
He might be completely inflexible. You know, Kevin Ollie might be the most inflexible, rigid coach at the pro level. I don't have a clue. But I think the situation, the one thing I do feel relatively strongly about is I feel like the situation they're in best suits a younger assistant or a college guy or whatever it is who can grow into the job and use the first couple years to work out the kinks and get his feet under him and learn him, kind of like what Spoelstra did in Miami. You know, but I don't think the context will allow that because of the Kobe thing.
Well, because of the Kobe thing, and to be honest, the Lakers is a very difficult start.
It's a very difficult start job. But next year is likely to be a good learner's year regardless.
Oh, well, on paper, it absolutely is. But like you said, the context makes it difficult. I mean, it's a very demanding fan base as it is. And when you throw in two shit can coaches leading up to the moment, two unpopular shit can coaches leading up to this moment, it's going to be a very difficult learn on the job.
You're right.
Even if it should be. I'll tell you what would be so intriguing, and I mean, who knows if he's even interested, but Fisher, just with the idea of if Kobe were unhappy, would he be willing to undercut his bestie? I mean, would he actually be willing to undercut, you know, like it reminds me of that scene in Unforgiven, right before.
Yes, he would.
Right before Eastwood's about to go back to the bar and kill Gene Hackman and everybody, when he's talking to the Schofield kid and he says, you know, I'm not going to kill you. You're the only friend I got. I mean, if they hire Fisher could be the only friend he has on this team. You know, if Powell's not back and it's a brand new roster that doesn't know him, it would be so intriguing to see how much levity Kobe would give a guy who really is one of his closest, most trusted, you know, professional and personal friends.
Would you rather have Byron or Fish? Both guys who, you know, obviously have strong Laker ties, which is part of the appeal. And, you know, but Byron has much more experience than Fish. Who would you rather have of those two guys?
Probably Fisher, if only because I'm more intrigued by what he would be as a coach. And, you know, like Brian Shaw, and obviously the book is still open on Shaw, that, you know, Denver had a difficult season, but I don't think that was entirely on Shaw. And after, I think, a rough opening stretch, he got the guys more or less on the same page. Fisher's always seemed like one of those guys who's a coach in the making. You know, Byron, I think, has his positives and negatives that have been established. I mean, in Byron's corner, and I know you're not a huge Byron supporter.
Yeah, he's fine. He's fine.
Right.
He's
but I mean, fine. You know, he's done.
If he wasn't a Laker, I don't think people would want him on the list.
That,
most
that
people.
Be true, but you know,
he's fine. He's not a bad coach. He's just right. He's inspiring.
He's helped bad teams get better, you know, particularly on the defensive end. You know, he's got a pretty, I think, strong personality. And he is somebody that I don't think would be intimidated by the prospect of facing Kobe one-on-one. But probably Fisher. I threw a name out on Twitter that I think would be the best call of all. Nick Young player coach.
He's I think he's actually put that out there himself. He's promoted that.
Well, idea. He took it from me. There's no, I was
absolutely. I have no problem.
Either way, Brian, it's been made pretty clear by Kobe during his appearance on Thursday night's episode of the Jimmy Kimmel Show. He would like to be in the loop in terms of who they hire for the next coach.
Yeah, it was a good line. He was like, well, they didn't consult me for the last two hires. I think for the third time, I would like to at least be, get a phone call. And yeah, they should talk to him, if only to keep him sort of in the loop about what they're doing and what their thinking is and why.
He's earned that respect.
Sure. I mean,
he absolutely has earned it.
Obviously you can't give anybody who's on the team control over who they hire. But the problem is that they have to figure out how you go from Kobe to the next guy. The best coach for Kobe might not be the best coach for, throwing a name out there, Kevin Love or Kevin Durant or whatever it might
be. Or the next Kevin.
What if they could only get stars named Kevin?
They'll have to pry Kevin Ollie out of retirement, bring him back.
Like, as part of the new CBA, like, that's how you get guys. Like, instead of a draft, you have like a yearly draft, you have a name draft.
That's a terrible way.
You could only draft people by the letter B. Like, you start with B.
It's just an awful way to run a league.
It is. It's terrible. It would be.
And that just wasn't worth a lockout.
I'm thinking Sheamus was a reach. There's never been a quality NBA player named Sheamus before.
Kobe, it's perfect. He's one of the greatest. Oh, there's no other Kobes?
There's no other guys? Certainly, yeah. Somebody's named their kid after him. But anyway, yeah, I mean, you tell him. It's worth getting his input, because apparently they're just not very good at doing this. So the more people you get, the better, I guess. I mean, but just call him. Call him. It's easier to call him.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, Kobe's really earned the right to be called. He should be in the loop. I mean, I remember when they hired Mike Brown, and Kobe apparently found out about it, through SportsCenter or whatever.
I believe he was watching the ticker, yes.
Yeah, both of them were very critical of that. I mean, that to me was one of the most alarming things Jim Buss has ever done.
Well, especially in the context of that, it was like, in such a sensitive time after Phil was gone, after Kobe so clearly wanted Bishaw and all that kind of stuff.
But I mean, that to me is business 101. I mean, because beyond the fact, as I've said a few times now, Kobe has earned the right to be in that loop. He's far too big a pain in the ass to make feel slighted like that. Mm-hmm. You don't want to put yourself at odds with Kobe over something that should be incredibly obvious. I don't think he should get a vote. I don't think he should have a seat at the table, and I don't think they should cater this choice around Kobe, but do the dance.
You know what? You know what they did, Andy? They put Baby in a corner.
Exactly.
You don't put Baby in a corner.
No, and I mean, I do think it's a little bit funny, the inferred point Kobe was making to Kimmel about the first two not working out, that they didn't consult him about, maybe they ought to talk to me, is he's leaving out the part about him actively undercutting both guys. I mean, and that is part of the reason, not the only
reason. And he was
reason.
Relatively charitable to Antoni and pointed out that he had bad circumstances on the show.
On the show he was.
That's all I'm saying.
He has said a few times that D'Antoni got dealt a rough hand because of all the injuries, which is true. But it would be, I think, pretty disingenuous to say that Kobe has been particularly outwardly enthusiastic.
He has not been a champion for Mike D'Antoni.
Right, towards either Mike. And when your franchise player, particularly one as strong-willed as Kobe, who, one could argue is the most powerful guy in the franchise, isn't really supporting the coach, shit like this is inevitable. So, I mean, he is kind of leaving that part out of it. But either way, he absolutely should be consulted.
We noted earlier, Andy, the Kevin Durant Mother's Day speech, or some people refer to it the MVP speech, and the incredible moments of, sincere vulnerability and openness, where he talks about the poverty that he and his mother and his brother grew up in, and the sacrifices that his mother's made, and the way he went through every single teammate and pointed them out.
Literally all of them. He mentioned some guy, Grant, on the team. I don't even know who the hell he was talking about.
Grant? Some fella named Grant.
I have no idea who the hell he was talking about. I mean, he went through everybody.
And so, he goes through all these things. It was a remarkable speech and says a lot about the guy. And I think, the popularity of Kevin Durant as a player and a person has gone through the roof. But one of the more interesting aspects of the speech and the vulnerability of it and all of this is, in a lot of ways, it reflects a different kind of player. The way that star NBA players are might be evolving, at the very least, away from this kind of MJ, I will eat your children and your children's children, and the Kobe Bryant, every year I don't win a title is a colossal waste of my life and all that. You look at LeBron and the way he approaches things, and you look at Durant and the way he approaches things, it seems, at least on the outside, that the alpha male NBA star is evolving.
Yeah, I think there's no question. We've seen that for a while between the big three teaming up and, you know, really putting ego aside. All three of them are guys who had been used to being the guy on a team, and they all had to share a bit of the spotlight and the glory and give up, you know, beyond whatever you want to label their financial sacrifice, you know, which, by the way, a lot of these guys do keep score. Clearly, Kobe among them. You know, it is not an accident that he remained the highest player in the league,
highest paid player. That was good.
Yes, it was good.
That was very good.
It's not my first day at the office, but you know, it's not an accident that he ended up with that status. That is something that clearly matters to Kobe. And you know, Lee Jenkins wrote a terrific profile for Sports Illustrated leading into this season about Kobe, called The Last Alpha Male. And it really was an appropriate title, because I think these guys now, you know, this generation of LeBron and Durant and Bosch and Westbrook, they're all alpha males. I mean, you can't succeed the way that they do in professional sports at the highest level, you know, particularly with these guys, all scores and stuff like that, without being alpha males. It's pretty much impossible. But they don't necessarily have that same desire to show that they're the bloodthirstiest one out there or prove it's my team. The concept of whose team it is doesn't necessarily seem to matter to this generation of player. You know, we saw that with Dwight Howard after a few years of, you know, trying to choose his largest market and, you know, will the torch be passed to him with the Lakers from Kobe? He ended up going to Houston and sharing that spotlight with James Harden in a smaller market. You know, I don't think it matters to these guys the way it used to. I think winning really matters a lot, but they don't necessarily care about the credit that comes with winning. They just want the opportunity to win.
Yeah, and I mean, they care, but I think they care differently. I think the whose team is it, alpha dog, whatever thing, remains much bigger a media construction than on the team. And I'm not saying these guys don't have egos. That's not the point.
No, they all have egos.
A lot of them have massive egos, and they should, because they're really good at this. You know, Russell Westbrook plays with basically nothing but ego. But I don't get the impression that he does these things specifically at the expense of Kevin Durant.
He thinks he can
and he should take it. And this is just how he's programmed. But I don't think he's trying to steal, wait for it, KD's thunder by taking 58 shots a game.
I don't think Russell Westbrook gives a crap whether you think he's Batman or Robin. I really don't. I don't get the impression that he plays in any way threatened by perception of him. I mean, if anything, I think Russell Westbrook's made it pretty clear he doesn't give a crap what anybody thinks of him.
Yeah, by the way, it was Grant Jarrett was the guy you're talking about.
I have no idea who that is.
I do not know who that is.
I have no idea who that is. And Durant spent like 2 minutes thanking him. He really did.
I had no idea who that is. You're right. I have none. Yeah, but it's, and I think our perception of this in LA is, and you know, you cannot like, you know, underplay the success of Kobe Bryant.
No.
As a player and, you know, in the NBA and all that. But he's changed the culture of how particularly, I mean, I think it is sort of a national phenomenon. It is a big internet, you know, puffy chest, social media thing. This whole, like, you know, winning is the only thing. It's all the you know, matters and so on and so on and so on. People who don't think that way are somehow deficient and will, you know, can't be winners.
Well, but, and it's also, too, it's fanned by the media and, right. you know, the
24-hour news and
24-hour news and, you know, shows like First Take that end up, you know, debating whether somebody possesses the clutch gene.
ESPN, ESPN2, Fox Sports 1, you know, the new NBC, there's a CBS Sportsman. There's so much air, and it's best filled with these kinds of totally unnuanced debates. But I think in LA in particular, because Kobe comes by this genuinely, and people, you know, bear with me here for a second. If you think it's contradictory what I'm about to say, it really isn't. Kobe comes by this genuinely. This is what he believes. This is how he has constructed his reality, that he finds he has taken the Michael Jordan approach. He finds slights whether they exist or they don't. He finds motivations in things that either should motivate him or have nothing to do with him. Whatever it is, the way he stays on edge is he has to be, as he'll tell you, an asshole. He has to be a pain to work with, but he's also maniacally driven, works harder than anybody, and all these other things. All of this is true, and all of this is what fuels him. At the same time, he's also hyper aware of the image of Kobe Bryant and the myth and the mystique and the legend of Kobe, and is very good at feeding it. And as a, you know, with 20, basically what's going to amount to 20 years of soaking it in as a city with so much success and so much incredible play, LA has been Kobe-fied in that way, where we look at Durant, who last year said, no, it wasn't a wasted year of my life. I got to play basketball professionally. I grew as a player, grew as a person. And we look at him and say, aha, he can never be a winner.
Well, that he doesn't care as much as somebody else. I mean, it was a stupid, to be honest, it was a stupid media constructed talking point. I mean, and you know, I'm not trying to pick on Ramona Shelburne, who's our friend, and ask the question, but to frame it that specifically, you know, do you think of not winning a championship specifically as a wasted year of your life? Right.
The mistake, not to get too insider-y, but the mistake she also made too was like, do you mean as a professional, as a human being?
It's such a narrow way to measure his response. I mean, it's honestly kind of a stupid talking point that, you know, the local media has still been bringing up for like a few years.
But think about this, though, Andy. Think about this, though, because, you know, I think obviously Durant and LeBron and all, Durant is much more cut from the LeBron cloth. And LeBron has clearly shown that, yes, his mentality is one that is capable of winning. And, you know, he's grown in his willingness to be more of an A and defer a little bit less because it's what the team needs and all these other things. But think about what the next guy who shows up in LA as the star. We've talked so long about what it's like to fill Phil Jackson's shoes. What hasn't been discussed quite as much is what it's going to be like to be the next star after Kobe, not necessarily because, wow, you have a lot of success to live up to, but because of the way that LA has been conditioned to think about its basketball stars. Like, Laker fans think that stars, their star, must think and behave and act or whatever in a certain way.
Well, I mean,
honestly, it's gonna be really hard.
Honestly, that is a reason Dwight left. That is absolutely a reason Dwight didn't stick around. I mean, think about it. He actually did, Dwight, certain things that Kobe gets deified for. He came back early from back surgery, major back surgery, played through a lot of pain, a lot of discomfort. And instead of Kobe, who gets lionized for it, rightly, Kobe plays through a lot of pain and deserves a lot of credit for that. Dwight got shat on because he wasn't looking like Dwight Howard.
Right.
I mean, but some of that is because of how Dwight conducts himself. Right. And I'm not trying to present this as Dwight being a perfect player.
No, I mean,
he's not. He's
and he was a prima donna, and he was a baby about a lot of stuff. If he had been willing to roll, Mike D'Antoni might still be here.
Right, but you know, roll literally on the court and figuratively. But as we've said, you know, I've certainly said many times in this show, I don't blame the guy for leaving. He was put in a no-win situation, particularly once Kobe announced that he was sticking around a few years, because then you become the guy that is waiting for the torch while getting criticized for not having
it. I just think
you can't win.
But the next step of that is,
it's going to be tough.
We talk a lot about, there's a lot of debate, and I know we get a lot of crap for pointing out that not everybody wants to come play with Kobe, that Kobe's presence is more of a hindrance to drawing star talent than it is a help. But a star who's paying attention to the LA market, do you want to be the next guy? It's just something to think about. I mean, it hasn't been talked about. We're still 2 years away from it, which is probably why it doesn't get a lot of talk. But you know, it's absolutely true, and it'll be interesting to see how that plays out going forward. What else is going to be interesting to play out going forward, Andy? That's exactly right. We have Ask a Kamenetsky. You ask us questions via Twitter at Cam Brothers or Facebook. Kamenetsky Brothers is the Facebook page. One question this week, Andy. Just one, because there's so much other stuff to do. One fabulous question.
Good enough. Let's be honest. Let's not sugarcoat this. The rest of y'all failed miserably.
Okay. Well, your way is the truth.
Yes.
Mine is the nice, more sort of face-saving. Your way is the Kobe way of handling it, and my way is the nice way. But your way could get better questions next week, so.
Step it up, man.
Not about being popular.
No.
At M. Leon Kwan, at Cam Brothers, top five people you would like to do a podcast with, alive and not living, otherwise known as dead.
I'm very dead.
As my friend Georgia once said, the phrase is, an unsharp knife is an unsafe knife. They have a word for unsharp. It's dull. Yeah. Anyway, go ahead. So, which five people would you like to do a podcast with, alive or dead? Do you want to go first? Which did you do?
Well, we divided it up, Brian, right. And I chose dead guests.
Dead guests, okay.
The unliving.
But presumably, though, reanimated. Otherwise, no matter how interesting they would be terrible guests.
Right, absolutely. And they were all reanimated. Right. We're not going with holograms. These are the actual...
No, the actual people, but living versions of them as opposed to the dead ones.
Right, right. I travel back in time or whatever with podcast equipment. And
in and of itself, enough to get anybody to talk to you, because that would have blown their minds.
Oh, a few of these people, they're absolutely...
You remember what happened, the first people who sat... You don't remember, but I mean, you've seen what happened. You read about what happened, the first people who saw a movie.
Yeah.
Like the train that was driving towards the camera, they all got up and ran out of the theater.
Well, it's like that old Letterman top 10 list, top 10 things Abraham Lincoln would say if he were still alive. One of them was, Iron Bird.
Right, exactly.
But anyway, I chose non-living guests, and it was difficult because there were a lot of people, you know, icons that I would love to sit down and talk with. But then I thought about, I wanted to try to have the opportunity to have, you know, maybe either discussions that haven't taken place before, or guys that haven't necessarily been over interviewed. Like someone like John Lennon would be an absolute thrill for me. But at this point, you've read just about every single John Lennon interview
right.
You ever can have. Aside from how much I'd love to just meet him, the interview didn't necessarily.
Right, and it's hard. Yours is a hard one too, because most people are dead.
Right, exactly.
There are far more dead people.
Right, exactly.
It's a bigger pool.
I felt the same way about like Hendrix or Bob Marley or Johnny Cash, Paul Newman. Then I thought about people like J.D. Salinger or Lou Reed, but I'm like, you know what? They hated being interviewed. I don't want to waste that time interviewing someone who doesn't want to be there. Then I ended up going with these five.
Okay.
William Shakespeare.
I talked to him.
Because he's somebody that really, I don't know how much we truly know about him in his own words. We really only know like historical third person accounts of him. And he's been so influential in everything.
I don't think really. You have to explain why Shakespeare would be a good podcast guest.
That's fair enough.
It's self-evident, but you know, it's a good reason. But I'm just saying, I think most people are like, yeah, that makes sense.
That's true.
That's nobody was sitting enough. There going, what? You can interview anybody? You took Shakespeare? What is the matter with you?
William Shakespeare, not William Hurt.
Right. I mean, what a dumbass.
No offense to Billy Hurt, but
right. Right, and so from two,
Miles Davis,
good one.
Frank Zappa.
Mm-hmm.
Richard Pryor.
Good, that's a good one.
Jesus. And specifically, what I would want to ask Jesus is, explain everything in the Bible, the way we're supposed to interpret all this, What were we supposed to be thinking so we can all stop arguing?
So it's really a PSA.
It's a PSA, and also, I mean, I'd love to find out, you know, what's got like.
No, yeah, I mean, no, look, ask. I mean, first of all, from a rating standpoint.
Oh, yeah.
Jesus.
That's a get. Just about any guest on the planet is capable of getting bumped. Jesus will never get bumped. If he's on a talk show, you will never bump Jesus. But
I'm
yeah.
I'm sorry, Jesus, the Little River Band ran long today.
what do you expect? We had all the Kardashians, Jesus.
We will be happy to have you back at whenever it's good for you.
So that's my list. Shakespeare, Frank Zappa, Miles Davis, Richard Pryor, and Jesus.
Jesus meaning Jesus Christ, not Jesus from the Big Lebowski.
No. And the two guys who came closest to making the cut were Arthur Ashe and Picasso.
Those are good. Those are very good.
It's tough.
Living people. The opposite of not living. So I thought the first one was pretty obvious. I went with V. Stiviano. Kidding. I'm not using a podcast on V. Stiviano, although I would, if we got her, I would certainly put her on the podcast.
You know, she's going to run for president one day, Brian.
Well, then if she wins, then I'll add her to the list. Bill Murray.
Oh, he was on my alive list.
Elon Musk, the guy who runs Tesla.
Okay. Okay.
You know, I find people like that interesting. I wanted somebody, some sort of innovative, big idea business type guy.
And it's the people Kobe looks up to. He was
a guy who was sort of the first one to pop. I tried to go very stream of consciousness. Who pops into your mind?
Sure.
Tom Hanks.
Okay. He'd be terrific.
Charlie Rose.
Oh,
because
turn
tables. Here's my thinking. Because what we do for a living, in part, is have conversations with people and, you know, the art of talking to people. And nobody knows that better than him. And I think it would be fascinating to talk about not just the people he's talked to and talk about his life talking to people, but also the art of interviewing and things like that. I think that would be a fascinating thing. And then Kobe Bryant would get us a lot of clicks. So I went with Kobe.
Kobe would get us a lot of clicks.
Kobe gets a lot of clicks, and he's a great interview.
When he is in the mood, Kobe is a phenomenal interview.
Also thought about a former president. I wanted a former president because you can't interview current presidents. They don't tell you anything. And so my initial thought was Bill Clinton.
Oh, yeah.
But then I thought, you know, he's kind of in, you know, he's back in the news with Hillary and all these other things. And, you know, he's fascinating. And the era that he presided over was a fascinating one. But I, you know, are you going to end up getting more spin now than you would have, like, if Hillary wasn't running or something like that? So I'd still probably go with him. But then I thought, like, the first George Bush, H.W., he might be kind of interesting.
He's creepy. I don't want any part of that.
All right. Well, even regular W, other W would be.
he'll never find the studio.
That's not fair.
You didn't say inaccurate.
No, he could find the studio.
Driver can find the studio.
Come on. All right, so those are my guys. Bill Murray, Kobe Bryant, Tom Hanks, Charlie Rose, Elon Musk. It's not a bad lineup.
That's a good list.
And again, it was very stream of consciousness. I'm sure people could argue about some of those choices. But I was basically trying to go actors, athletes, you know, semi-tastemakers or people who understand culture.
Hey,
and
who's the guy who just told me you don't have to explain your list?
No, Andy, you were trying to justify Shakespeare as a guest on your podcast. You know, we can get Shakespeare or Arnovitz. And I love Arnovitz, but, you know, even he would be like, get Shakespeare, man.
Well, I wouldn't get Arnovitz. He's alive.
That's true.
You're the one who has to explain Arnovitz why you didn't book him.
Right. Good point. All right, so that's ACK for this week. And as Andy said, step up your game, people. Better questions next time. One little piece. Every once in a while, we do a segment called Recommended Reading. Go to Grantland.com. Most Laker fans, I would imagine, have seen this, but if you haven't, go to Grantland.com. Jonathan Abrams, great writer over there, has a very entertaining oral history of the 2002 series between the Kings and the Lakers. It's awesome. It's worth a read. Go read it.
All-time favorite playoff series for me. That is my all-time favorite. I can't recall a series that was more exciting, more entertaining, more venomous. These two teams despised each other, and you had just two incredibly talented teams going head to head. I mean, game seven required overtime, as it should have.
He should have put you in the oral history.
He should have.
Yeah. All right. So that's it. I don't think when we come next time we record, it's not like we're going to know who the coach is, but we'll keep talking about that kind of stuff. There'll be more playoff things to talk about, and something will happen, and we'll record again. And until then, thanks for listening. Oh, by the way, go over to ESPNLA.com, and we'll tweet it out to our podcast with Steve Mason. Lots and lots of great stuff with Gregory
Elwood
from HitFix, talking about summer movies. So we'll tweet that out as well, but give it a listen. It's fun stuff for the summer movie season, and we'll see everybody next time.